Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUSCast. I'm your host, Grace Gotchling. On May 5th, 2020, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the case United States Agency for International Development v. Alliance for Open Society International Incorporated, a case regarding the scope of the government's funding power to limit private speech. This is the second time this case has been argued in the court. Like the prior appeal, this case addresses whether the government has the power to compel speech from grant recipients who received government funds to combat HIV and AIDS worldwide. This episode will provide an overview of the court's prior opinion, the First Amendment impact of this case, and several key points that the court will likely address in its opinion. To discuss the case, we have Casey Maddox, Senior Fellow of Free Speech and Toleration at the Charles Koch Institute, and Crystal B. Swensbo, Associate at Wiley Ryan LLP.
Great. And thank you all for joining us. We will begin with just a little bit of discussion about the procedure of the telephone argument. This is a new thing. We're only on the second day ever of these sorts of arguments. So we'll talk about that just briefly, provide a quick background on the case for those especially who don't know much about this case. We'll provide an explanation of how we got here and what's at issue. Then we'll talk some about the issues that the court discussed and the potential implications of the decision, and then we'll wrap up by taking any questions. So I guess just to begin, and Crystal, feel free to jump in here, but the court held telephonic argument, and just so everyone is aware of how that is working, instead of the normal process where justices can sort of jump in at any time and ask questions, the way the court is doing that for these telephonic arguments is to begin with the most senior justice, and they each ask one or two questions and sort of move through the court. So after the first few minutes where the attorney is beginning their presentation, then they quickly move to questions and move through the court, basically just one or two at a time. So it's a very different dynamic than we've heard in other arguments. I think one of the downside of handling it this way is that it probably devalues the questions asked by the more junior justices because they can't come earlier on in the argument where they could sort of more shape the way the conversation is going. It's also very orderly, though, so it has that advantage. So,
well, Casey, I'll point out, I mean, Justice Thomas is known for being silent on the bench. He has asked questions for the last 2 days in a row, both to petitioners and respondents. So maybe the order is good for that part, but it does end up being a very different argument when you have the order, the justices going in a more procedural order like this.
That's right. And I think you'll probably hear it when we get to the end. I think it makes it a lot more difficult to read tea leaves. Not that tea leaf reading is ever easy, but it seems a little more challenging to read tea leaves from the court coming out of an argument where it is that structured, because you don't know which justices are so passionate about one particular point that they keep coming back to it or something like that. So that can be a little more challenging. So Crystal, if you want to give a case summary.
Absolutely. Thank you, Casey. So fundamentally, this case is about the government's power to dictate speech by conditioning grant funding on the adoption of the government's anti-prostitution message. Speech requirement is part of the Leadership Act, which was originally passed in 2003, has authorized over $80 billion to combat HIV, AIDS, and requires that no funds may be used by an organization, quote, that does not have a policy explicitly opposing prostitution, end quote. And that's the policy requirement that's really an issue here. So this is the second time this case has come before the court. 2013, the court ruled that the funding requirement violated the First Amendment, because it required the respondents, at that point, just domestic grant recipients, to pledge allegiance to the government's policy. The almost identical issue is presented to the court again today with a slight twist. So the policy requirement was originally found unconstitutional as applied to respondents who were domestic organizations. The respondents this time, same entities that were before the court in 2013, but now we're talking about their closely related foreign affiliates. So it's domestic grant recipients that are large enough to have a foreign affiliate. Now, based on the record, the foreign affiliates are virtually indistinguishable from the domestic entities. They share branding, messages, they speak with one voice. Respondents argue that the 2013 decision effectively resolves the question here. Dictating the speech of their closely related foreign affiliates is the same as dictating speech for the domestic entities. It's unconstitutional, a violation of the First Amendment. Now, the government's argument draws a fine distinction based on corporate formalities of the domestic and foreign entities. And frankly, it flips the First Amendment argument on its head, asserting that there are no constitutional barriers or limits to dictating the speech of foreign entities, which I think puts us in a little bit of a different ground for First Amendment arguments. So, Casey, what do you think of the argument?
Well, you know, like I hinted at the beginning, I find it difficult to really gauge which way the court is going to go here. I think the change in makeup of the court may impact that, not having Justice Kennedy here. My sense is that this is, and we have Justice Kagan, as she did before, had recused. We probably should have mentioned that up front. So there's an eight-member court hearing this case. I think there is at least a decent possibility that the court splits or that they find some way to basically punt on an undeveloped record. So it was a very different conversation this time than the last time in that the government wasn't really asked to justify very much why it was imposing this, why it was necessary. The conversation was much more about basically whether rights were violated, whether the corporate form question, it was those kinds of conversations rather than what is the government's interest it's attempting to advance. That was not really part of the conversation at all.
I agree. Usually it seems like these First Amendment cases focus on the government's ability to do something. The government has to justify their standard or their policy. Here, the government really kind of came out of the gate in their brief and even an argument to say there's nothing to stop us, which I think is kind of a bold position for the government to take.
Yeah,
so, Casey, why do you think the government took this case? I say we had a strong opinion back in 2013. The Second Circuit here, you know, held that 2013 expanded a little bit. It expanded the 2013 opinion to apply to these foreign affiliates. So why are we looking at the case now?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, you generally assume that the court doesn't, you know, just take a case in order to affirm, and, you know, that you would make money betting that way. The court doesn't take money to affirm, doesn't take the court to affirm. And here, you know, if AOS wins, that's what the court has done. And so why take the case at all? Why not let the issue develop before taking this up? But it certainly did not seem from the argument that there was a strong sense that the court was trying to draw a line and was clearly leaning toward the government here. And so it didn't seem that you know, it was trying to rein in its prior decision, for example, here. So we may have to wait to find out why the court took the case and, you know, why not wait until let the Second Circuit's decision stand and take the next one. So I don't know. I don't have a good judgment, I guess, for how I expect the court will rule. Do you have a guess, Crystal?
I say I don't right offhand. I was a little surprised. I expected, you know, Justice Roberts wrote the prior opinion, so I expected him to come out of the gate a little bit stronger on the government burden side of this. I didn't hear those kind of questions. And then some of the hypotheticals posed were very tough. And it really, I think, put the onus on respondents, even though they had been successful in the lower court, to justify why their First Amendment rights were being violated, which I think was a little surprising. So I may be a little biased here. I, you know, worked on one of the amicus briefs submitted here, and obviously not speaking for our client there. But I'd like to think that the court will affirm. But I'm curious in what way they will do it, and what, if any, lines they draw, or if this might ultimately be a cutback on their strong opinion from 2013.
Yeah, and you know, I think there was a lot of concern. Or at least a lot of questions, maybe I should say it that way, from the justices about the potential implications of a decision for AOS, what other government programs might be affected. And, you know, there were questions from Alito, from Kavanaugh, at least along those lines, you know, just sort of querying exactly where this would go. I didn't think that they got particularly strong answers on those questions. And they ranged everywhere from the Mexico City policy, which in some of this we can talk about a little bit later on, Mexico City policy, the foreign
campaign finance
contributions, right, exactly, in U.S. elections. And then a lot of hypotheticals that were interesting hypotheticals about, what happens if you have grants to organizations internationally that are promoting peace in the Middle East and the U.S. government requires them to adopt a specific internal policy about their views on Israel, for example. Okay. And my sense was that those are very good questions with not particularly fine answers to sort of cabin a decision. I don't know if you had a different thought on that.
No, I think that's fair. As in, it might be worthwhile to talk a little bit about some of these hypotheticals in depth. So, for example, one of them I think was a really tough one to answer. I believe it was by Justice Alito talking about, Justice Kavanaugh talked about what if we had a policy that required the recognition of Israel in funding peacekeeping efforts in the Middle East. Would that particular requirement be acceptable? And obviously, respondents' counsel answered it. This is kind of nearing the end of the argument, noted that there's a difference between a fact that is required to be spoken and then something like the policy requirement here. That's more of a belief. And it was a kind of a quick answer, and I think it fulfilled the question. But it obviously raises additional concerns. We had NIFLA versus Becerra that talked about compelled speech for facts. That was obviously a problem. So I think these hypotheticals raised kind of bigger issues that we didn't get the opportunity to dive into during the argument. And because the justices weren't able to kind of pile on each other's questions or ask follow-ups, I don't think we got the really in-depth answers that, response counsel was prepared for or that might actually be illuminating on these issues.
No, that's right. So, I mean, on that particular question, there wasn't then the opportunity for a justice, as you would have expected, basically, if the arguments were in the court, to have immediately said, but what about NIFLA? Didn't we say, and then have a back and forth and hopefully get to a more refined answer on the question. So you're sort of left with this, it's because it's that would be a factual argument rather than, or even the opportunity for a justice to clarify, okay, well, let me fix my hypothetical for you. That's a little more challenging to do in this context with a much more structured argument. I'll walk through just quickly some of the main kind of strands of First Amendment jurisprudence that are at issue. I think there are at least a couple that are really presented here that are going to weigh on this decision, the compelled speech cases and the unconstitutional conditions cases, and sometimes those overlap. But the compelled speech cases, obviously going back to cases like West Virginia versus Barnett, where the Supreme Court had held that the government couldn't force Jehovah's Witnesses to salute the flag. So you have that case, Woolley versus Maynard, where New Hampshire had tried to have the live free or die on every license plate and was not going to make an exception again for a Jehovah's Witness in that case. Hurley versus Gay, Lesbian, Irish Americans of Boston, where the government was applying a non-discrimination rule to try to require a parade organizer to allow people in who were going to be representing a message that they didn't want to have in their parade, a group of gay and lesbian individuals who wanted to march in the St. Patrick's Day parade with them. NIFLA case that we mentioned, where the pregnancy centers in California were being required to provide certain disclosures, some of which would have been arguably just factual information, but they had objections to doing that. And the Supreme Court held that those were protected free speech rights against compelled speech in those contexts. And in the Hurley case, it has not been mentioned here, but seems to me quite relevant Healy was, if you go back just a little bit, the early 1970s, universities, Central Connecticut State had decided that it would not recognize a student organization because of that student organization's association with a national student organization that had allegedly engaged in violent activities. And so the university wanted this student group to sign a pledge that it did not support the use of violence. And the group said basically, well, we don't use violence, but we will not sign a pledge of support in that way and engage in that compelled speech. The case was decided as a freedom of association case, but it's often thought of as a compelled speech case and frankly looks a lot like the facts here, at least with the domestic organizations that have come before. The unconstitutional conditions cases obviously are, you know, government can't do indirectly by withholding government benefits or privileges, usually what it can't do directly. And those are cases like Keishian versus Board of Regents, where you have a faculty member. The state of New York was requiring all faculty members to pledge that they were not a member of the Communist Party or never had been a member of the Communist Party. And so that personal pledge requirement, again, that sounds a little like the situation here in 2013, at least with the prior version of the case. The political patronage cases from all through O'Hare Truck Service, which is one of my favorite interesting First Amendment cases where the court had held, where the benefit at issue is something you have absolutely no right to. So in that case, it was sort of a rotation for towing companies who wanted to be able to do towing for a community in Illinois. And the Supreme Court held that even there, the government couldn't take people out of the towing rotation on the basis of protected activity. In that case, the O'Hare Truck Service, the owner of O'Hare Truck Service had supported the mayor's opponent, political opponent in an election. That violated the unconstitutional conditions doctrine. The sort of exception to all of this, or the kind of offshoot of these cases, are the government speech cases. Cases like Russ versus Sullivan, where the government is providing funding for a private entity to speak the government's own message and can thus require them to say something or refrain from saying something as a condition of the grant. And Rust is the what's often thought of as the gag rule case, the abortion gag rule case, where entities were not permitted to provide abortion referrals in that case. And that was deemed permissible because it was as part of the grant program. So that's kind of the history of the cases that are leading up to the situation here.
One thing I found interesting, and I think is a recurring theme in the cases that you mentioned, is what's the injury here? We've talked a lot about you can't be forced to say something. The government shouldn't be allowed to compel you to say something or to put words in your mouth. There's also the potential injury of your speech being chilled. There's a limitation or a punishment imposed for speaking in a certain way. But I think, and both of those were brought up during the argument today, but there's a kind of a third category of injuries that I thought might play in here more than it actually was talked about during the argument. And that's the right to avoid having to rebut the government's point. So it's not, yeah. I think the government here has made the argument, it doesn't matter if we impose our regulations on the foreign affiliates. Domestic entities, you can just clarify any confusion. There's no issue. You just have to say, no, we disagree, because you have the freedom to say what you want. But public confusion regarding who the speaker is isn't really kind of the main issue. It's really a point that if the government's policy was allowed to stand here, the domestic entities effectively are required to rebut or to correct what is being said. They're having to kind of stand up and correct the record. They're having to overcome the government's thumb on the scale, as it were. And so I think that's a unique area of injury that I didn't see talked about a lot, but it was definitely kind of running through the NIFLA decision we've talked about, and American Beverage versus San Francisco out of the Ninth Circuit en banc talked about this as well. It's not necessarily that you will solely be chilled from speaking further, but that you shouldn't be forced to say something, including a correction for the government's misstatement or a way to counteract the government's forced speech.
And that, I think that's a good segue to talk about some of the kind of issues that have been bubbling inside this case. There was a line from the 2013 decision that was concerned about the government's mandate there requiring the domestic organization to have to engage in evident hypocrisy was the line. You want to talk a little bit about mm-hmm. that, Crystal, and how you think that plays today?
Sure. So the origin of this line came from questioning by Justice Ginsburg and Justice Kennedy back in 2013. In that case, the government forced the argument goes, it's evident hypocrisy to force contrasting hypocritical messages from one side of an organization, but allow the other side to speak freely. The line received heavy, and this line was again restated in the court's 2013 opinion. Basically, the idea is if you have a free speaking side of the organization and a hampered side of the organization, it effectively undermines the entire message because you can't have what you can't speak out of both sides of your mouth. Now, this line received heavy attention from the court today. Justice Breyer kind of noted that nothing has really changed since the line was written in 2013. Justice Ginsburg, again, revisited it. And Respondent's counsel, I think, nicely summarized why this evident hypocrisy is a problem. And it sounds terrible, but there's obviously kind of a practical problem as well. Imposing a speech requirement on only part of an organization is just as bad as imposing it on the whole organization, because the requirement undermines the credibility and integrity of the entire organization's message, which particularly here where we're dealing with HIV, AIDS, it's important to have that kind of trust from the local community and to work with individuals to make sure that if you can serve this end properly. If folks in the local community don't trust the speaker or don't trust an organization because, hey, out of one side of their mouths, they say, we don't support prostitution. The other side, they you know, have to work with individuals who have been in the prostitution industry, or you have to kind of work within a government structure. You want to make sure your message is consistent and that you can be trusted and that the aid you give will be trusted. And frankly, the evident hypocrisy the government is requiring here undermines that power.
The case that I did not mention earlier, that I usually will mention in these contexts, and I'll mention now, that I think is interesting in light of the evident hypocrisy concern, is the Christian Legal Society versus Martinez case. That's a case that is a compelled speech, compelled association, religious freedom. It's a kind of a combination case, an unconstitutional conditions case. It's basically the case where the Supreme Court held 5-4 when we were a few justices different than we are now on the court, that it was permissible for the University of California, Hastings, to have what was called an all-comers policy, and a policy that required every student organization to adopt a policy that it would not discriminate on the basis of, among other things, religion and sexual orientation. And its non-discrimination policy, but they interpreted that policy in an all-comers sense to mean that basically every organization had to agree to allow everyone to stand for office. And so that was the issue that came before the court, and the court upheld that 5-4. It's a similar kind of, you must adopt, it's not so much a, you know, we require you to say these words out loud, but we require you to change the internal documents for your organization in a way that reflects the policy that the school wants reflected. And the evident hypocrisy point there to me comes in where the concurrence from Justice Kennedy says that, well, if the organization is actually taken over, then the organization can come back and sue and challenge the fact that it is no longer allowed, or that it has been taken over by outsiders who disagree with the organization, and that the court could look at that at that point. But that, again, seems to create this hypocritical situation where the organization, in order to sue later, would have had to already adopt a policy now saying that it has a policy that it would later say that it disavowed. And so that
very much a catch 22.
Yeah, it's this sort of odd situation where a private entity is placed in a position like that, where it has to say words that it doesn't really mean, and is basically then put on the hook to try to have to explain to other people, you know, what it means and why it doesn't actually agree with the government, even though it adopted the government's preferred message in its internal documents.
I found it interesting, this evident hypocrisy line coming up, again, for the very reasons you pointed out for CLSC Martinez. It signals kind of I think Justice Sotomayor referred to it during the argument. This is much more of a functional approach to First Amendment speech regulations. You don't really see this anywhere else in the law. And Justice Sotomayor kind of went through, listed a number of cases, Hobby Lobby, Hurley, a couple of others, to note that the First Amendment is less concerned with kind of a formality or even a corporate formality in this case, so much as it is concerned with imputation or affiliation. What did you think of that argument and that strain of questions in the argument today?
Well, the most interesting part of that to me was just how much it signaled how the First Amendment doesn't care about your politics, And you know, basically the way First Amendment doctrine works when it's working properly is that it should be protecting neutral principles. And so, you know, today we heard counsel for Alliance for an Open Society, which is a George Soros organization, citing Citizens United favorably. We heard Masterpiece Cake Shop. We heard Justice Sotomayor pointing to Hobby Lobby and Hurley. So, you know, that's all very healthy. It's, you know, the First Amendment should be applying and protecting things. If it's not protecting speech that you don't like, then, you know, if you're not able to cite the First Amendment in support of speech that you don't like, then you may not have a very well-developed understanding of what the First Amendment is supposed to do. So I think that was all very positive, but it is very interesting to, you know, to see how these principles end up working in, you know, in ways that are, you know, protecting the speech of, you know, more than one side of the political calculus. I think to your question about the, you know, the attribution test, there were concerns from both Justice Roberts and Justice Thomas about exactly what this would look like. How do we know that an entity is in fact, you know, closely associated, mm-hmm. and is that the right test? You know, these are legally separate entities, and you know, what is the line going to be in future cases, or potentially, what are the facts that they cite in this case to be able to show that, you know, here the speech of the domestic organizations be affected by the international affiliates adopting this policy because of public perception, because of co-branding? You know, what exactly are those factors?
You're right. And Justice Roberts and Justice Thomas kind of went into this in some detail, which I think this might go to your earlier point. We're not sure what the court will do with this case. This case has been going on for 15 years. So there's been a lot of back and forth, and the government, you know, obviously sought discovery from respondents on this point. Respondents have a pretty sizable appendix of affidavits and testimony talking about how the organizations are similar and how their messaging is similar. But it's interesting that we haven't really seen a test develop. Obviously, respondents' counsel talked about it a bit during argument today, but a real test hasn't kind of come up. And it seems interesting to have a test be developed without the government really going into the interest that's compelling a test or that would allow them to limit speech in the way that they're doing here.
Crystal, I think we've already hit some on some of the long-term consequences. Do you want to touch on that, or should we head over to questions or?
I'll have one question.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to kind of kick it back to you a little bit. So there were two policies you mentioned up front, the Mexico City policy, and then the campaign finance bar. I want to get your thoughts, particularly on those two, just because I think campaign finance is, a difficult question. Frankly, it was a hard question when it was raised today. The Mexico City policy, I think, is kind of front and center of a lot of people's minds and thinking how this case will tie going forward.
Yeah, and I think the answer, at least on the Mexico City policy, is you know, basically the two ways that this has been distinguished from Mexico City, both in the Second Circuit below, and I think in some of the arguments we've seen, well, reading between the tea leaves and some of the questioning today, was distinction here. The argument they're making here is that this is affecting the domestic organizations, not the international affiliates, but the domestic organizations' free speech rights. Because of their close association. That seems to me to be largely not the case in the Mexico City policy context. There may be circumstances where it is. The other big distinction with the Mexico City policy and the one distinction that I heard today on the campaign finance bar on foreign contributions is the distinction between a restriction on speech for a grantee and compelled speech. There are the Supreme Court has said, at least, you know, in passing before, that compelled speech is, you know, particularly bad. And what I don't think we actually have from the court is a clear holding that, you know, much like viewpoint discrimination is even worse than content discrimination. Both may be bad, but viewpoint is really, really bad. What we haven't heard is the Supreme Court say, and compelled speech is worse than a speech restriction in a way that we will recognize a clear constitutional difference, where if this had been merely a speech restriction, it would have been okay, and the government would have been there would have been no violation here. But because it is compelled speech, it's a different thing. That may end up being one of the possible implications of this case. If so, it will be quite significant. I think it's been, like I said, it's been sort of hiding in some of these, and the NIFLA case even, that's, you know, particularly concerning, the idea that pregnancy centers would not only be prohibited from saying a particular thing, but would actually have to affirmatively state the government's message. I don't know if you have other thoughts on how this case may affect those issues.
No, I think you've kind of summarized it. And I know folks, if they have questions, we'll get to those in just a moment. I do think your point about the distinction between compelled speech and then speech restrictions may make the difference for this campaign finance hypothetical. I think that may be not an easy way, but it could be a clean way for the court to address that and hopefully, you know, cabin its opinion to the extent it needs to on that front.
We'll now go to the first question. Once you hear the prompt, you may ask your question. Casey, Crystal, it doesn't look like we have anybody in the queue. Do you want to go into a little bit more depth on what you were talking about at the end there?
Hey, I would say we can certainly talk a little bit more about the hypotheticals. And I don't know, Casey, I've had, as I noted, we've written a brief for this case, and my firm has been involved in these First Amendment issues for a long time. So it's always been interesting to see what type of policies the government uses or tries to use its funding power for. So I think my favorite one, even more recently, you know, there was one state attempted to prohibit boycotting the state of Israel as a condition of public employment, required contractors to cease and refrain from engaging in constitutionally protected speech. This is out of the Western District of Texas in 2019. So to the extent there's any thought that, oh, allowing the government to use their spending power in this way will not have a large effect, I think there are constantly cases coming up where, you know, states and other government entities are using their funding in a way so they can dictate the marketplace of ideas. And this case, I think, kind of opens the door for more of that.
Yeah, you know, I think in terms of other possible implications here, I mean, even for commercial speech issues, where you have a lesser, you know, First Amendment standard that's applicable, you know, if the court decides this case in a way that essentially treats compelled speech as different than speech restrictions and more pernicious than a speech restriction, then that could potentially have implications for some of those cases, or at least those would be opportunities for further development if that was the case, because at least some of the compelled speech disclosure requirements, even in the commercial context, might be kind of newly questionable, I guess, at that point. But yeah, I mean, I you know, philosophically to me, it makes sense. I think the, you know, you can't sort of cabin, once you are required to say something, especially a, you know, a statement of opinion, if you're required to say something, there's kind of no putting the genie back in the bottle. A speech restriction that says, you know, particularly you can't say this in this context because you're receiving this funding for this period of time or something like that, I think there is a difference in character between being limited with what your entity can say and, you know, which is a right you can nevertheless exercise at another time in another way, and a compelled speech, which, you know, once you have uttered words, you are on record with, you know, having taken a position. It's you know, arguably more difficult to sort of backtrack on that.
Very much so. It changes the content. It's very much a content-based restriction, as the court previously found.
Right.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.